This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, June 16th, 2004. Exceptional. Isolated. That's how U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald H. Rumsfeld described the abuses, the torture that has been seen throughout the world at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. He made those statements on May 4th of this year. Then, in a nationally televised address on May 24th, President George W. Bush spoke of, quote, disgraceful conduct by a few American troops who dishonored our country and disregarded our values, end quote. Yet, revelations of documents from the Department of Justice, August 1, 2002, and a Pentagon document of March 6, 2003, reveal that not only is this systemic and systematic procedures, but there is torture and the absolutist state. Our program today on Taking Aim. Ralph?
This is not a phenomenon that we have failed to describe. In fact, before the Abu Ghraib disclosures, we had done a two-part program on torture as the signature of the gangster state, in which we delineated it as standard procedure. But what is distinctive and what is emerging and what is forcing itself upon everybody's attention and understanding is that however long and however endemic the utilization of torture has been in all imperial adventures by U.S. capitalist rulers, whether in Vietnam or in Iraq, what is distinctive now is the formal open proclamation of the entitlement. It's no longer a matter of hiding behind the facade. It's no longer a matter of plausible denial in which these operations are undertaken by covert forces, by special forces and Phoenix programs. It is now openly proclaimed as the entitlement of the absolutist state, and indeed it is the architecture of the fascist state in preparation that we are now witnessing.
In May 2004, a member of the 377th Military Police Company told the New York Times that labeling of prisoners in Afghanistan as enemy combatants not subject to the Geneva Conventions contributed to their abuse. Quote, we're pretty much told that they were nobodies, that they were just enemy combatants, he said. I think that giving them the distinction of soldier would have changed our attitudes towards them. Yet, in memos from the Pentagon and the Justice Department, the President of the United States, as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, was told that he was not bound by U.S. or international laws prohibiting torture when acting to protect the national security, and that such laws might even be unconstitutional if they hampered the war on terror. The U.S. created offshore prisons offshore, such as Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and maintained detainees in undisclosed location, where they sent suspects without any legal process to countries where information was beaten out of them. That's called rendition. Ralph?
The lawyers ascribe broad power to Bush on torture. A detailed article in the Los Angeles Times on June 10th of this year. In a memo dated weeks after the invasion, administration counsel said the president's authority superseded Congress and superseded the law. And the article in the Los Angeles Times observes that presidents in past have claimed special powers. In the Civil War, Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, and Franklin Roosevelt issued an order authorizing the military to intern thousands of Japanese Americans. But in all those instances, the president acted with the nominal authority of Congress. Rarely has a president claimed an authority to ignore a law, to ignore Congress, to ignore legislation, and to act with impunity as a sole authority. And the 56-page memorandum, Detainee Interrogation in the Global War on Terror, maintains and states that the president, as military commander, cannot be restrained in any way. Quote, Congress lacks the authority to set terms and conditions under which a president may exercise authority as commander-in-chief to control the conduct of operations. Congress may no more regulate the government president's ability to detain and interrogate enemy combatants than it may regulate his ability to direct troop movements on a battlefield. Accordingly, we construe the law to avoid this difficulty and conclude that it does not apply to the president with respect to detention and interrogation of enemy combatants. And this memo, as you mentioned, Maya, dated the 6th of March of 2003, proceeds to set forth the thesis that the very attempt to implement laws that restrain torture or to invoke the Constitution or Congress is itself illicit. According to the memoranda, Congress does not have the authority in any way to restrict or to impinge upon arbitrary presidential decision. Quote, it is an extraordinary claim. It is as broad an assertion of absolute authority as I have ever seen, said Michael Glennon, war law expert at Tufts University. It is a claim of unlimited executive power. There is no reason to read the commander-in-chief powers trumping the clear power of Congress. It eliminates any restraint through Congress or through law. It is an argument that I have never seen made before, said Douglas Laycock, a veteran military lawyer. This commander-in-chief's fighting powers trump the restrictions of the Geneva Convention, and I'm having a difficult time following their logic because this is a new type of authority, a new type of claim where the restrictions that we accept through legislation, through law, through congressional restraint are swept aside and considered no longer to apply.
The Bourgeois Press notes, Time magazine, Redefining Torture is the headline. Did the United States go too far in changing the rules, or did it apply the new rules to the wrong people? June 13, 2004. Pentagon report set framework for use of torture, by Jess Braben in the Wall Street Journal, June 7th, which was the first newspaper to reveal this document. Memo offered justification for use of torture. Justice Department gave advice in 2002. That is from the Washington Post about the August 2002 Justice Department memo by Alberto R. Gonzalez, the counsel to the president. But let's go back to the Pentagon memo, because as Ralph says, it completely redefines the notion of torture. It is the Working Group Report on Detainee Interrogations in the Global War on Terrorism, Assessment of Legal, Historical Policy, and Operational Considerations, dated March 6, 2003, classified by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld for at least 10 years. That means that the body of the report, aside from the attachments and several pages, was released by the press and is available on the Internet, portions of which are blacked out. And it defines what torture is. Torture means, quote, any act by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted on a person for such purposes as obtaining from him or a third person information or a confession, punishing him for an act he or a third person has committed or is suspected of having committed, or intimidating or coercing him or a third person for any reason based on discrimination of any kind. When such pain or suffering is inflicted by or at the instigation of or with the consent or acquiescence of a public official acting in an official category. And then note that on the basis of this definition of torture in the Geneva Convention, this large document issued March 3, 2003 goes on to state how what will be done to the prisoners in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in other places throughout the world is outside of this definition. Ralph?
Wall Street Journal is very explicit in its delineation of this important memorandum. The president, despite any domestic or international laws constraining the use of torture, has the sole authority as commander-in-chief to approve any physical or psychological actions during interrogation, including torture, the report states. And furthermore, civilian or military personnel accused of torture or other war crimes have the defense, which includes the necessity of using such methods to extract information, and what is known as the Nuremberg defense, namely that the accused was acting pursuant to an order and that there was no moral choice involved or possible. And according to Bush administration officials, the Wall Street Journal states, the report was compiled by a working group appointed by the Defense Department's General Counsel, William J. Haynes II. Air Force General Counsel May Walker headed the group, but listen to who's in it. The top civilian and uniformed lawyers from each military branch, the Justice Department, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and all other intelligence agencies. In other words, this is not some arbitrary usurpation of authority on the part of Bush per se. Bush is being authorized to act in this absolutist fashion by the entire national security apparatus of the capitalist state. The Pentagon disclosed that the working group has been assembled to assess interrogation policies and to determine the methods that may be used, including torture. And furthermore, the working group elaborated that the Bush administration's view that the president has unlimited power to wage war as he sees fit includes the position that neither Congress, the courts, nor international law may interfere, that neither the president nor anyone following his instructions is bound by federal torture statutes or by any other restraints.
Ralph, I think it is instructive to look at this memo because you see the convolutions, the thinking that they went through in order to rationalize anything and everything that they would want. And you also see the basis for 9/11, because with 9/11, they say the United States has entered into a state of war. And being in a state of war, that gives the president, as commander-in-chief, ultimate authority. And they point to U.S. law as precedent. Now, this will all go before the Supreme Court, particularly with the status of the detainees in Guantanamo, because in this document of the March 6th document, 2003, the Pentagon claims that the detainees in Guantanamo are outside of international covenants like the Geneva Convention or the Torture Convention because Guantanamo is under U.S. control. Yet, in its arguments before the Supreme Court and the courts, the United States, the executive of President Bush, was arguing that the detainees in Guantanamo are outside the U.S. law of habeas corpus because Guantanamo is outside of the boundaries of the United States. Now, let's look, as I mentioned, at what is said explicitly here. The United States has reservations that it has put forward that step outside of the Geneva Convention and the Torture Convention, which was ratified in 1994. And one of this is that it does not apply to operations, quote, of the military during an international armed conflict. And also, the Department of Justice concluded that international law cannot bind the executive branch under the Constitution because it is not federal law, meaning that the president himself is exempt from international law. And it states that concerning the detention and trial of Al-Qaeda or Taliban militia prisoners, if the executive wasn't exempt from this, it would be controlling the executive, and it would and that would be outside the realm of the powers that are given to the president by the Constitution. Ralph?
Justice Department memo justifies torture. Department of Defense 2. The memo in 2002 from the Justice Department provided a total justification for the usage of torture. In August 2002, torture is justified, and international laws against torture are unconstitutional if applied to interrogations conducted in President Bush's war and through his directives, according to a newly obtained memo, describes the Washington Post in its article on June 8, 2004. The newly obtained memo is that which was issued by the Justice Department in August of 2002. If a government employee were to torture a suspect, he would be doing so in order to prevent further attacks on the United States, says the memo from the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. And it adds that arguments centering on necessity and self-defense provide justifications that eliminate any criminal liability at a later time. The memo counters a pre-September 11, 2001 assumption that U.S. government personnel are not permitted to torture captives, and it is offered after the CIA began detaining and interrogating suspects in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And indeed, it goes on to provide the basis for the 2002 memo written for the CIA and addressed to White House Counsel Alberto Gonzalez, in which the Justice Department defines torture in such a fashion as to permit the president to authorize whatever methods he deems fit without restraint and without consequence.
So it's a good thing you mentioned that, Ralph. The memo for Gonzalez, the president's counsel, was written in response to a request by the CIA, and the Pentagon memo was written in response to the staff at Guantanamo who wanted to institute, quote, harsher interrogation methods. Now, let's look again at the Pentagon memo, because it says, quote, a defendant is guilty of torture, meaning U.S. military intelligence or U.S. soldiers, are guilty of torture only if he acts with the express purpose of inflicting severe pain or suffering on a person within his custody or physical control. In other words, they have to be express purpose of inflicting severe pain. If the pain is inflicted, but it wasn't their intent to inflict severe pain or suffering, then it is not considered torture, according to the Pentagon. Also, they say it cannot be general suffering. It has to be specific intent, not just general intent.
Well, Newsweek correctly describes this as a tortured debate. Amid feuding and turf battles, lawyers in the White House have been discussing specific torture techniques, such as waterboarding and mock burials. What that means is that people are held underwater until they are almost drowning and asphyxiated, lifted up and put back into water in which they nearly asphyxiate, and then they are subjected to being buried alive, where they are informed that they're going to be buried alive. And Newsweek describes it in detail. President Bush has ordered a series of covert directives authorizing the CIA to set up secret interrogation facilities and to use new, harsher methods. The CIA and the FBI confirmed this. It extended into the White House with Condoleezza Rice National Security Council and lawyers for the president. An explosive August 2002 brief, the Newsweek article says, from the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, disclosed by the Washington Post and drafted by former OLC lawyer John Yoo, authorizes the president to employ methods of torture at random and at will. It began with methods like waterboarding and also with mock burials, in which the captives were led to believe that they were being buried alive, Newsweek blandly reports. So we're talking here not about anything abstract, but very specific methods that can only be described as the most fiendish forms of torture. And in fact, in the Newsweek article, there's rather an evocative account of how one of the detainees was handled when he was sent to Egypt with specific instructions where he would be subjected to elaborate torture under direction of the Central Intelligence Agency. And before going, the chief interrogator told him, and I'm quoting from Newsweek, "When we get you there, I'm going to go to Cairo and find your mother and fuck her." Newsweek describing the methods that come right down from the White House. Specific methods countenanced and contemplated by these criminals that occupy positions of power in the United States.
Ralph, according to the Pentagon, that pain and suffering in itself isn't torture, but it must be, quote, severe, and it also must be prolonged. Now, they do say that severe mental pain or suffering, if there is a threat of imminent death, is torture, such as a threat of electrocution or a threat that another person will be imminently subjected to death, severe pain or suffering, such as a family member. But remember, it has to be intentional, that it is an intent that you are saying that there is a threat of imminent death. And also, the severe mental pain and suffering must be evidenced by, quote, prolonged mental harm. That means that there I'm quoting here, that it must cause some lasting, though not necessarily permanent damage. For example, the mental strain experienced by an individual during a lengthy and intense interrogation, such as one by state or local police might conduct upon a criminal suspect, would not violate U.S. law, would not be considered severe mental pain or prolonged mental harm. Also, the use of drugs are allowed as long as they don't have severe mind altering. In other words, they can use psychotropic drugs as long as they do not have severe impairment where a person would totally lose their mind. It is incredible when you read this document, the extent to which they go to rationalize torture. And above all, the part that is most recognized in the bourgeois press is the fact that the Pentagon, at the direction of Donald Rumsfeld, is assigning to the president as commander-in-chief absolute authority. It says, the Supreme Court has recognized that the president enjoys complete discretion in the exercise of his commander-in-chief authority, including in conducting operations against hostile forces. And they go on to say that as a result of 9/11, where there was the attack on the Pentagon and the attack on the World Trade Center, as such, the United States is in a state of war. And that is the commander-in-chief that has absolute authority, and that Congress, quote, lacks authority to set the terms and conditions under which the president may exercise his authority as commander-in-chief to control the conduct of operations during a war. The president's power to detain and interrogate enemy combatants arises out of his constitutional authority as commander-in-chief. Also, they assign the president the right to determine who is an enemy combatant, whether that is a person who is a U.S. citizen or not a U.S. citizen. And the president has full authority to detain an enemy combatant for as long as he so wishes. Ralph?
These discriminations that you're citing, Maya, are understood and explicitly stated by such as Kofor Black to be without meaning. These are techniques that involve sensory deprivation, total isolation for weeks and months at a time, deliberate and calculated removal of all sensory impression, even smells, light, total cutting off of the senses so that people dissociate and begin to break down. There is no attempt to discriminate between short-term and long-term effects, but quite the contrary. And to understand the significance of this, the Knight Ridder newspaper posted on June 10th the following. Many Iraqis believed to be lost in Abu Ghraib prison. More than 1 million people are missing. More than 1 million people are missing. There is no way to tell how many have slipped into obscurity after being arrested by U.S. forces. They have disappeared. 1 million people in Iraq is the equivalent of 12 million people in the United States. And prominent amongst this lacuna of people who have disappeared are multiples of children. Children have disappeared in large numbers.
Ralph, the an important report was produced by Human Rights Watch, June 2004, called The Road to Abu Ghraib. And it's on the Internet, and I suggest our listeners take a look at it, because it goes step by step to explain how what took place at Abu Ghraib is consistent with the measures taken by the administration and with U.S. policy, I must note, not just now, but throughout the history of the United States, and will show how this was so at the time of the Vietnam War. The change now has to do with the Pentagon and the Justice Department justifying this as standard procedure outside the limitations of any United States, or actually they're saying it's consistent with U.S. law, but outside the limits of the international conventions on torture by assigning in a state of war full power to the commander-in-chief, being the president. And the Human Rights Watch notes that the severest abuses at Abu Ghraib occurred in the aftermath of a decision by Secretary Rumsfeld to step up the hunt for, quote, actionable intelligence among Iraqi prisoners, and that teams of interrogators from Guantanamo were sent to Abu Ghraib. As you may recall, in one of our previous shows, we mentioned how Miller, the head of Guantanamo, not only went to investigate what was going on at Abu Ghraib, but they sent teams of people to train the people at Abu Ghraib, and one of their main points was that the military police should soften up the prisoners and work with the military intelligence. And as Major General Taguba in his report states explicitly, this goes against the standard operating procedure, the manuals of Army procedure. But this was the procedure at Guantanamo, and this became the procedure at Abu Ghraib. The commanding general in Iraq, writes Human Rights Watch, issued orders to, quote, manipulate an internee's emotions and weaknesses. Military police were ordered by military intelligence to, quote, set physical and mental conditions for favorable interrogation of witnesses, end quote. The captain who oversaw interrogations at the Afghan detention center, where two prisoners died in detention, was the one who actually posted the, quote, interrogation rules of engagement, end quote, at Abu Ghraib, authorizing the coercive methods, such as the use of military guards to instill fear, that violate, notes Human Rights Watch, the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture and other cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment or punishment. So much for plausible denial. As Human Rights Watch and others have noted, it was the very captain who oversaw the interrogations at the Afghan detention center where two prisoners died who posted the interrogation rules of engagement with these policies at Abu Ghraib. Ralph?
Redefining Torture, June 13, 2004, Time Magazine. A series of leaked legal memos has revealed that since late 2001, the administration has been fundamentally reshaping America's stance on torture, contradicting 50 years of policy governing the treatment of detainees. The memo meticulously lists all the laws against torture and then offers methods of evading them. This is the leaked motif, and here is Seymour Hersh. Seymour Hersh, in a speech that he gave recently at the University of Chicago, this is dated June 14th, made the following statement. I have seen all the Abu Ghraib pictures. You haven't begun to see evil. Then he trailed off. Horrible things are being done to the children of women prisoners as the cameras run. And he stated he was frightened, even recalling them. This is not a restrained use of physical abuse. This is the unremitting use of torture, mutilation, disappearance, and death.
Ralph, the memo to Gonzalez, as the Justice Department memo, as well as the Pentagon memo, refer to doctrines of necessity and self-defense as justifications that eliminate any criminal liability on the part of any officials who torture detainees. Now, both these memos, aside from taking very narrow views of what might constitute torture, wiggling out of all the basic definitions and what anyone with any common sense would call torture, they say that even then, because of necessity and self-defense, not only is torture allowed, but the Pentagon memo goes on to rationalize homicide itself. In other words, it's okay to kill one person if you're going to save two. Now, the one of the memos refers to seven practices that U.S. courts would have ruled to constitute torture: severe beatings with truncheons and clubs, threats of imminent death, burning with cigarettes, electric shocks to genitalia, rape or sexual assault, or watching a prisoner to watch the torture of another person. Yet it says that these are okay. It then advises that, quote, interrogation techniques would have to be similar to these in their extreme nature. Note, extreme nature, if they are going to violate the law. But if it's not in the extreme, then it's acceptable. Ralph, before we go on, let me remind our listeners that this is Torture and the Absolute State, brought to you on Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoen
and Maya Schoen over WBAI 99.5 FM in the greater New York area and on the internet at www.wbai.org. Ralph.
To put this in its perspective, the London Observer on the 13th of June, 2004, the secret world of U.S. jails. The United States government is running an invisible network of prisons and detention centers in which thousands have disappeared without trace. In the past 3 years, thousands have been transferred around the world, often in secret operations that bypass extradition laws. The astonishing traffic has seen many, including British citizens, sent to countries where they are tortured unremittingly to extract information. The disclosure of this shadowy system will increase pressure on the Bush administration over its cavalier approach to human rights. The article continues. Few escape. The ghost network of detention facilities, which range from massive prison camps, such as that of Guantanamo Bay, to naval vessels in the Indian Ocean, so accounts of life inside the new gulag are rare. The article is detailed in delineating how Abu Ghraib is not just the tip of the iceberg. It is only the little beginning of a policy that extends far beyond Iraq and Afghanistan to all parts of the world. And indeed, that is a description in The Observer in London, which places in perspective the article then that appeared in the Los Angeles Times on June 11th, A Long Record of Abusing Jailed Foreigners by Mark Dow. The first I heard about rituals of sexual humiliation in prison had nothing to do with Abu Ghraib. It was from a Nigerian, an elected state senator in his own country, forced to strip naked and remain on his knees for hours with his hands on another naked male prisoner. You think this may have happened to him in Nigeria? No, it occurred in New Jersey when he was detained by American immigration authorities. And the article by Mark Dow details the constant and the prevalence of sexual humiliation, of rape, of physical abuse, of dousing of the head underwater until people asphyxiate, as a standard procedure, of the immigration authorities affecting thousands over a sustained period of time in the United States.
Ralph, the Human Rights Watch pieced together information on 13 key detainees who have completely disappeared. In other words, they are in undisclosed locations among, what you say, the thousands. But these are key detainees, such as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who have disappeared. Now, there's a declaration on the protection of all persons from enforced disappearance, and it's from the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. And despite that, the 13 are Abdul Rahim al-Sharkawi, who allegedly coordinated logistics for al-Qaeda, Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, who was a training camp commander, allegedly, Abd al-Hadi al-Iraqi, another supposed training camp commander, Abu Zubaydah, who supposedly was the senior operational planner and heir to Osama bin Laden, Omar al-Farouk, who supposedly planned the attacks in Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines, Abu Zubair al-Haidi, the deputy to Abu Zubaydah, and others. Those are six of the 13, and I could go on with the list. And these people are supposedly top al-Qaeda operatives. They have completely disappeared. Even the Red Cross has no access to them. There is no notion of how they are being treated and what torture they are being subjected to at all. And this is against conventions that the United States has signed on to, such as the protection of all persons from enforced disappearance. Ralph.
There is no evidence that the people that you've mentioned are connected to anything called an al-Qaeda apparatus whatsoever.
Oh, Ralph, that's
the operations,
right.
The operations that are ascribed to these individuals, such as the USS Cole, such as the blowing up of the embassy in Nairobi, and other such events, have all been documented as false flag operations in which U.S. intelligence operatives and FBI officers were, in fact, the principal organizers.
That's why, Ralph, I said what the people who the United States has alleged are the al-Qaeda operatives.
No, I understand. I think, though, that the point has to be made that what indeed we have here, more often than not, is the detention of people who have had an intelligence association with the United States and are in a position to disclose, as Zacharias Moussaoui has been doing, the hand of the Federal Bureau of Investigation of the intelligence agencies in these putative operations ascribed to terrorists. Here in the Washington Post on June 13th, Iraq tactics have a long history with U.S. interrogators. A CIA handbook on coercive interrogation produced 40 years ago during the Vietnam War shows that the techniques now used in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay have a long history with U.S. intelligence based on research and field experience. In fact, the article continues, declassified 10 years ago, the training manual carries in its title the code word used for the CIA in Vietnam, KUBARC, Counterintelligence Interrogation, July 1963, and it was intended with this handbook to train interrogators in basic methods, coercive techniques available for use in the interrogation situation. These techniques involve electric torture, amputation, mutilation, burials alive, and throwing of people out of helicopters, the standard procedures that were used ubiquitously throughout Vietnam, with tens of thousands of detainees subjected to torture, mutilation, and death. The very substance of our series of hearings in the International War Crimes Tribunal on U.S. war crimes in Indochina, and the subsequent hearings of Citizen Soldier and the International Commissions of Inquiry, in which soldiers in their multiples came forth to give evidence about the standard procedure of wiring them up, of ringing them up, of cutting off their noses and ears and displaying them in necklaces around the necks of the Special Forces soldiers. The KUBARC manual offers a menu of options, the article continues, for weakening the detainee. Weakening is some euphemism. Sleep patterns eliminated. The subject so disoriented that he is a subject to constant fear and helplessness, and very frequently, death as the consequence of electric torture.
Ralph, one of the U.S. officials who worked on the Pentagon report, the March 2003 report, stated, quote, "We've been at this," meaning the interrogations at Guantanamo, "for a year plus and got nothing out of them. We need to have a less cramped view of what torture is and is not." According to this official, the interrogation techniques included drawing on prisoners' bodies, putting women's underwear on their heads, threatening imminent harm to their families, but this had not borne fruit, and what they needed to do was, quote, ratchet up the pressure. So a list of 20 interrogation techniques was that were to be permitted was drawn up that included reversing normal sleep patterns of detainees, exposing them to heat, cold, and sensory assault, loud music, bright lights. And then there were other techniques that could be used, quote, and justified as militarily necessary, but they had to be have the approval of senior Pentagon officials and, in some case, the defense secretary. CBS News reported that Donald Rumsfeld did approve such treatment for Mohammed Khatami, and this included reversing sleep patterns, cutting off his beard, playing loud music, subjecting him to interrogation sessions lasting up to 20 hours. Now, what these reports are not stating is that people were shackled in positions where they could not move and were forced to urinate or defecate on themselves for long hours, where they were put in air-conditioned rooms where they were naked and where they were extremely cold and left alone for 8 hours a day for more than a month, where and sometimes for 24 hours a day. One report from Tarek Dergul, who was released and sent to Britain and was a former detainee in Afghanistan and had actually was an amputee and had stumps, said that the air condition would really be blowing. It was freezing and it was painful on particularly his stumps. They were chained, they were shackled, and one of the shackles is called a short shackle. Steel bonds pulled tight to keep the subject bunched up, chained to the floor, and so that if you move, you end up with cuts.
The Kupark memorandum is discussed in the following context. When John Walker Lind was tied to a stretcher naked and held for long periods in a large metal container, it was based upon what had been done 50 years earlier, in which detainees were, quote, placed in a tank-type respirator, with the subjects only able to breathe barely, but their arms and legs enclosed in rigid cylinders to inhibit movement and tactile contact. Lying on their backs in minimal artificial light, the detainees could not see their own bodies, and the respirator motor was the only sound. The early effect of this environment was such stress, so unbearable for the subjects, that they lost touch with reality and dissociated, I am quoting. When it comes to torture, the payoff for these techniques, the manual said, is that when an interrogator appears as a reward of lessened anxiety, providing relief, sometimes the questioner receives information. Sometimes the questioner receives information. And when they don't, the detainee is left to suffer the consequences of this unremitting torture that goes on not for days and not for weeks, but for months.
They may not call it torture in Pentagon speak, but people die. Two people, Karim Abd al-Jalil, he was a former lieutenant colonel in the Iraqi army. He died January 9, 2004 at Forward Operating Base Rifles near al-Assad, where he was being interrogated by special forces for 5 days. The original death certificate issued by the army special forces said that he died of, quote, natural causes during his sleep. But pictures taken by the cousin of the body before burial depicted severe bruises on his abdomen, as well as marks and cuts on his arms and legs, especially around the wrists. Natural causes? Not according to the photographic evidence. Spiegel TV, a German news organization, interviewed another detainee who had been held with Abd al-Jalil, who stated that during the interrogations, American soldiers, quote, would kick him a lot, cuff his hands, place them behind his neck. They would also cuff his feet. Then one of them would hold his feet up while the other pulled down his head. They tossed him on his back and stepped on him. They danced on his belly and poured water all over him. Now, Abd al-Jalil had been held in isolation, and the Pentagon memo that was obtained by the Denver Post and reported by NBC reveals that the Pentagon knew that he was held in isolation with his hands tied to a pipe that ran along the ceiling. And, as I said, the evidence, though, from the people who were detained with him is that this man was so brutalized, and then when he was shackled, and he was shackled with his mouth gagged, and the Pentagon admits that he was shackled with his mouth gagged, he was found hanging and dead. But there was blunt force injuries and asphyxia, and that is also on a Pentagon memo. The two Pentagon memos don't agree. Natural causes during his sleep and blunt force injuries and asphyxia. And this was all done by the Elite Special Forces Unit, the most highly trained personnel in the U.S. military, those who are trained in torture tactics. Another person found dead is Nagam Sadun Khatib, who is a former Ba'ath Party official, and he was found dead at Camp White Horse Detention Facility near the southern Iraqi city of Nasiriyah, June 6, 2003. When an autopsy was done, it was revealed that he died from strangulation. And military records show that he did asphyxiate when a Marine guard grabbed his throat as he was trying to move him, so-called accidentally breaking a bone that cut off his air supply. Ralph?
Torture approved at the highest levels. Julian Conan in the Daily Telegraph in London, reporting from Washington on June 13th. The abuses were approved at the highest levels of authority, not just by senior Pentagon officials, but going to the White House itself. The Washington Post, the use of dogs to scare prisoners was authorized at the highest levels. June 11th, 2004, Josh White and Scott Hyam in the Washington Post. Forced nudity, a pervasive pattern, not isolated incident, authorized at the highest levels. New York Times, June 8, 2004.
Ralph, the Telegraph in the United Kingdom says interrogation abuses also were approved at the highest level. And then on Sunday, June 13th, they write, "The biggest bombs in this case have yet to be dropped." And they're referring to four confidential Red Cross documents that implicate senior Pentagon civilians, in other words, not in the military, in the Abu Ghraib scandal, and that have been passed on to an American television network, which has yet to release them. Now, the Red Cross, which usually keeps its documentation secret, but the Red Cross has been so outraged with the treatment of the detainees in Iraq that the Red Cross itself came out publicly and stated some time ago that this abuse had to stop. Ralph.
Here we have the Washington Post on the 13th of June, a look behind the wire in Guantanamo. Detainees told they were taken to be shot. A description of how detainee after detainee is taken out and faced with a firing squad in the firm belief that they were going to be executed. And here in the New York Times on June 5th, "Beating Specialist Baker" by Nicholas D. Kristof. And it describes how Sean Baker, who it says it doesn't sound like an Iraqi name, and it isn't. Specialist Baker is a proud U.S. soldier, Air Force veteran, member of the Kentucky National Guard, served in the first Gulf War, and a military policeman in Guantanamo Bay. And indeed, Mr. Baker was subject to the following treatment. "They grabbed my legs, my arms, and twisted me up. And I was one of the individuals who was thrown down, and they got up on my back from behind and put pressure on me while I was face down. Then they reached around and began to choke me and press my head down against the steel floor. It seemed like an eternity, and I could not breathe. I began to panic. The soldiers noticed, and they began to jump on me. I was screaming at them, I'm a U.S. soldier. I'm a U.S. soldier. Mr. Baker is suffering from seizures. The military has had to send him to Walter Reed Army Medical Center for a treatment of traumatic brain injury from the treatment to which he was subjected. A U.S. special officer and soldier treated the way they normally treat detainees. And here in the nation, under the banner of the War on Terror by William Greeter, the domestic context of American society is undergoing the most drastic and insidious changes. The quest for homeland security is heading in towards the militarization of everyday life. The security systems involving computers, cameras, remote sensors, electronic alarms, bomb sniffing dogs, and government agents everywhere watching people for dangerous intent, Washington assembling a unified watch list of troublemakers, their identities contributed by every federal agencies, names shared with local and state law enforcement, any motorist stopped by a patrol to be electronically checked with the FBI's terrorist screening center and held for questioning. The initial list will contain the names of 120,000 citizens regarded as a threat. The agro-terrorist identified by the Agriculture Department is someone who is trying to save trees. The article continues, the torture state and the absolutist state will not take as its victims those in other countries alone, brothers and sisters. This is the quasi-apparatus of the fascist state itself. Torture at the highest authority, no longer in plausible denial, but justified, rationalized, defended, and implemented.
Ralph, we should look at what happens to those who are caught, the very few who somebody complains about and reach the criminal investigation units, because this will have impact not just abroad but here in the United States too, as many people are aware when they try to bring cases against the police or prison guards. Over the past year and a half, the Army opened investigations into 91 cases, and there may be more, but the Washington Post Weekly Edition, June 7th, 13th, could document 91 cases of misconduct by U.S. soldiers against detainees and civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan, though mostly in Iraq, who were in custody or outside detention centers. Of these 91, almost two-thirds, 59 of the cases were closed, and only a few soldiers were ever disciplined. There were 14 court-martials and 7 non-judicial punishments. Now, this is especially worrying because 34 of these cases were deaths. There were 12 assaults, but 34 deaths, and 4 were cases of detainees, and they were ruled justifiable homicide. Remember, I was saying that there is this notion in the Pentagon of self-defense or necessity. Only one case at all resulted in disciplinary action so far of the 91 cases. Now, this is aside from the 7 disciplinary actions, the well-publicized ones that are now in the publicized in the press, and aside from 3 military intelligence officers who also have been publicized because of their rape of a female prisoner at Abu Ghraib. Aside from those 10, there are still all the others. Only one case resulted in a disciplinary action. Ralph?
Hiding a bad guy named Triple X, U.S. News and World Report, June 21st, 2004. The top U.S. commander in Iraq, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, has issued a classified order directing military guards to hide a prisoner, later dubbed Triple X by soldiers, from Red Cross inspectors, and to keep his name off official rosters. The disclosure by military sources is the first confirmation that Sanchez was directly involved in hiding prisoners from the Red Cross and in disappearing them. The ghost detainees, their number is not counted, but they are multiple.
And Ralph, recently there was a photograph of a man, an Iraqi, who was dead and wrapped up in a plastic bag. And what was noted was that he didn't have an assignment number from Abu Rab, that he himself had been one of the ghost detainees. Now, I mentioned that there were 91 criminal investigations, but what's interesting to note is why there are so few. And an article that appeared in the San Francisco Examiner, an AP article that's been produced throughout the country of June 9th, California Guardsman alleges abuse in Iraq, and you can see from this why there is so little reporting. This California National Guardsman, who himself is a prison guard here in California, he was stationed at an Iraqi police station. And he saw that detainees were abused during interrogation sessions where they were threatened with guns, cigarettes, lit cigarettes were stuck in their ears, and they were choked until they collapsed. His name is Sergeant Greg Ford, and because he has medical experience, some of which he got while as a prison guard, he was the one who was called in to revive the prisoners after they passed out. He then, on one occasion, saw a soldier stand on the back of a handcuffed detainee's neck and pull his arms until they popped out of the socket. Now, Ford, part of the 223rd Military Intelligence Battalion, north of Baghdad in Samarra, went to his supervising commander, who then said that he would investigate. He found nothing wrong, and in fact, they sent Ford himself on for psychiatric review, and then he was sent from Germany back to San Antonio after the evaluations found nothing wrong with him. Nothing wrong with him, and total denial that anything he ever reported had happened. Ralph, to sum up.
Sticking lit cigarettes in their ears, choking them until they collapse, pulling their arms out until they pop out of their sockets. This is the small example of a constant. And that is why Lindy England, the young woman who has been made so famous with respect to the sexual abuse and torture, has a defense team that is calling 100 witnesses from the highest authority, including Richard Cheney, to appear and to disclose their orders to carry out these practices. And that is why the Center for Constitutional Law is suing the mercenary company Titan, which has just merged with Lockheed Martin, which has provided the prison guards for torture throughout Iraq, as it has indeed provided them in U.S. prisons and provided them for goon squads to break unions across the United States. It is a seamless system. The torture state is systemic, and it is systematic. It is part of the apparatus of a decaying economy and a decaying ruling class that removes the mask from imperial rule and prepares it ubiquitously for our own people. This is the struggle that we have before us. This is the task that remains, to remove these people from power. If there was an American Revolution in the 18th century based on absolutist state and arbitrary authority, it was but a little taste of what we are about to experience today, brothers and sisters. And that 18th century obligation to revolt and to overthrow is no less theirs than ours.
Torture and the absolutist state, our Taking Aim program for today. You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell, that's P-A-C-B-E-L-L .net, or takingaim@wbai.org, or telephone us at 707-552-9995, or write to us at P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California, 94591. Audio tape cassettes and CDs of our programs are available from us. As well, we have an internet site with an archive of shows. That's at www.takingaim.info. We'll be with you next week.